From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's likely that for almost as long as we humans have been walking upright, we've been hearing this. The lion's roar. Now, there's evidence that both humans and an early ancestor to lions both prowled the earth some 3 million years ago. So these great animals really evoke something primal in us. Imagine then what it might sound like if that lion's roar were simply no more. Well, the African lion population has plummeted, roughly 20,000 left. That's it. So can they be saved? This hour On Point, the rise and fall of the king of beasts. You can join us on air or online. Is the lion your favorite animal? And are you upset about poaching or hunting? Or do you see a room for especially hunting in larger conservation plans for lions? Do you want to see increased conservation efforts? What should be the relationship between human beings and the king of beasts? Well, joining me now from London is Sarah Evans, travel and wildlife journalist, and she's also author of When the Last Lion Roars, The Rise and Fall of the King of Beasts. We've got an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Hello there.
It's very nice to have you. And, you know, we're going to spend a lot of this hour talking about current conservation efforts because, mm-hmm. you know, knowing that there are roughly 20,000 African lions left is, you know, it's a heart-stopping number. But I'd actually like to start, if it's okay, going way back in time. I mean, how long have humans or humankind and lionkind, how long have we shared the earth?
Well, the earliest fossils that we found of creatures that most resemble lions are about 3.5 million years old. But moving on to that further up, it's moving into the Ice Age, then it would have been at least around 20,000 years ago that we were interacting with Ice Age lions, cave lions as they're known.
Interacting with them. Okay.
Yeah.
So did these early lions, whether it be there's a fossil record from the ones 3 million years ago?
We have, yeah. We have, okay. That's an African fossil record where the lion originated in East Africa. And that's the oldest fossil that we have. Later on, we have a few more older fossils from Africa, but then most of the fossils, the bones, are all found in mainly in Europe and Siberia, also in North America and Mexico as well. And they were the Ice Age lions, the cave lions that we think of in our, you know, imaginations of a time when there was nothing else but plains and glaciers and that type of thing.
And so what do we know what these early lions looked like? Do they look like the lions that we see on the plains of Africa today?
The very oldest Ice Age lion, the ancestral lions and the American lions, we don't have any visual representations of those, but we have their bones and fossils, and people have put those together so they can see how big they would have been. And they would have been big, especially the American lion. That lion was three times bigger than the lions that you see in Africa today. It's an incredibly strong animal. So it was able to battle with the saber-toothed tiger, those kind of big beasts and mammoths. So it had to be big because most of the fauna then was pretty large itself. But the ones that we have in caves have been paintings by people of the cave lions. Mm-hmm. And they're thought to be around 18,000 years old.
Yeah. Well, so you write about some of these representations in French caves of cave lions, of particularly what you saw at the Chauvet Cave. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's in Ardèche in southwest France. That cave, it was not discovered until that long ago when some people who were exploring caves saw some air coming out of a little hole. And as they investigated, they found a way through into the cave and then literally could not believe their eyes because it had been completely protected from the environment. There were depictions of mammoths, lions, bison, horse, and as well as that, there were bones all over the floor, huge leg bones, thigh bones, things that they knew were not from animals of our time.
Yeah.
And so once they kind of alerted the authorities to that, people who are expert in dating this kind of thing and preserving it, put a special kind of screen around it so that no one could enter. Mm-hmm. Previously, a similar kind of cave found has been discovered in another place in France. And because they allowed visitors in, people's breath actually just decayed all the artwork on the cave walls.
You're talking about Lascaux, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
So they didn't want that to happen again. So they've actually built, what I saw was a duplicate of the original cave in the same area, and very carefully recreated to resemble everything from that time.
Well, I'd encourage listeners to go to onpointradio.org there, because we have an image of one of these cave paintings from Chauvet that Sarah's talking about. Again, this is a cave painting that's something like 36,000 years old. And specifically, you write about a part of the cave painting that's called the Panel of Lions. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at it today, and it's a stunning representation.
It's beautiful.
It's basically a drawing of a pack of lions in the hunt.
Yes. It looks like they're chasing bison, probably. And just the way that it's been drawn, and you think how, you know, all those tens of thousands of years ago that was created, we can look at it today and still have a connection with it. We can recognize it as a lion, and we can see that the lion's hunting, and we can feel their determination to get some prey. They're possibly their hunger, and it's quite a thing to be able to have that connection with an artist who lived so long ago in such very different times to ours.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, what's remarkable about it is they're describing the behavior of lions 36,000 years ago, right? Which means that these ancient humans were able to, they had such close proximity to the animals that they were able to witness their behavior in this kind of detail. So it just made me think that the interaction between human and lion goes back a long time.
It does, yeah. Many decades, thousands of years ago that we've been, I think it's true to say, in those pictures of the lions, you can sense some respect that the painters had for them and awe in those beasts, and it's something that we're still sharing today.
Yeah. Well, we are talking about lions, and, you know, in the modern day context, the African lion, its numbers in the wild are down to something like 20,000. That's a more than 40% drop in a couple of decades. And I'm speaking with Sarah Evans. She's author of When the Last Lion Roars, The Rise and Fall of the King of Beasts. And actually, Sarah, if I may, we've got a call coming in right now. Alexander is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Alexander.
Hello, and I wanted to just ask the question because in my thought, a lot of extinctions that happened within the history of humans happened because of humans, and then you have earlier history of millions of years where those extinctions were just natural die-outs. Does your guest feel that we might have caused the die-out of the cave lion?
That's a good question, Alexander. And actually, it's something that I, too, was wondering about, because there's so many species that we can think about. Everything, you know, the great auk, the dodo, things like that. I mean, those are just a couple of birds. But that very soon after human contact was made, those species vanished. I mean, Sarah Evans, is that true also for cave lions 36,000 years ago?
With the cave lions, it's thought that the most likely cause of their demise is actually a change in climate. So the climate basically started warming up, and as it started warming up, plants were able to grow much more strongly and forests started to form. And these cave lions were best hunting in the grassy plains, which suddenly then became filled up with trees, and they were just weren't able to hunt and to get at their prey like they had been. There has been some suggestion, and there is some evidence, that cave people were killing lions and eating them, but not on a big scale. So it's likely that we may have contributed to their demise, but we're not the cause, as we can say with like the dodo, for example.
Right. But then, you know, marching forward in time, I mean, we were talking about Ice Age depictions of lions. In your book, you write about how lions, like humans, were actually, they had at their peak spread around the world, right? Across Africa, Asia, Eurasia, North America, South America too?
We think they only got as far as Mexico.
Okay. Okay. But obviously, in most of these places, they are no longer there.
No.
So do we look to humanity, to humankind, for the disappearance of lions from all of these places, save a couple of hundreds in Asia and those 20,000 in Africa?
The evidence suggests that we are the cause, unfortunately, and that that's mainly down to hunting in all its guises, whether it's been trophy hunting on a big scale, whether it's been a Maharaja in India or somebody on safari in the 1800s, right back to the Egyptian pharaohs. There has been a lot of hunting going on of lions. It has escalated in recent times, which is accounts for the dramatic decline, but it's been a history of kind of violence towards lions in the whole.
And now we're down to 20,000 left in Africa. But before that, in the decades before the 1990s, there were a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah, there's believed to have been in the 1950s, up to 500,000 possibly, and then just gradually dropping down into the 100,000 in the 1990s. And that's just been, obviously, just as humans have developed and changed the landscape and technology, farming, population growth, it's all impacted on lion numbers.
Well, we'll talk more about that when we come back. We're speaking with Sara Evans. She's a travel and wildlife journalist. She's author of When the Last Lion Roars: The Rise and Fall of the King of Beasts. We've got an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. And I'm wondering what you think. I mean, if there are only 20,000 wild African lions left, what happens if they're gone? What happens if humans make them extinct? What do we lose as a planet, as humans interacting with nature, if the last lion does roar? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking with Sara Evans. She's a travel and wildlife journalist and author of When the Last Lion Roars: The Rise and Fall of the King of Beasts. And that fall may be closer than we think, because there are only some 20,000 wild lions surviving in Africa today and just a couple of hundred in Asia. I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is conservationist Kevin Richardson, known to many as the Lion Whisperer. He said in a 2013 documentary that the way things are going, lions may not last three more decades in the wild.
If we carry on along the same path, we will not see lions in 20 years. When my last lion dies, yeah, we'll probably be talking about the last lions been seen in the wild. We don't need clever humans coming in and telling the animals how to do what they know how to do naturally. Giving back habitat and restoring habitat, that would be utopia.
It could be utopia, but giving back habitat and restoring habitat involves people and people who are living in those habitats right now. And that's one of the complicated things about the question of how do we conserve and save lions. And we're going to dive into that a little bit more a little later this hour. But Sara Evans, can you just explore with us a little bit more about what are the most intense current pressures on lions? Is it trophy hunting, or is it the sort of the habitat reduction that we just heard Kevin Richardson talk about?
People tend to think that trophy hunting is a major cause of lion decline, but actually, if you look at all the threats that there are to lions, it's not one of the major ones. It can be in certain areas, it can contribute to lion decline. But as a whole, the biggest threat to animals, and of course the lions, is their habitat loss, which is being encroached under pressure because of human population growth and the need to farm the land that they have.
And do we know how rapid the habitat loss is for in the places where lions live?
It's different all over Africa, but it's something that's increasing all the time. In West Africa and Central Africa, the landscapes there are particularly under threat with population growth, which is predicted to rise, especially in countries like Nigeria, which are huge. So it's just been constantly under pressure. They think that in the last 25 years or so, the lion's lost 90% of its range in Africa. So it's lost a lot, and it's pretty much now confined to protected areas such as national parks, reserves. There's not too many just roaming the wilderness, as it were.
But I'm reading, you know, in your book and elsewhere, mm-hmm. that there's increased pressure on lions in addition because of this rise in the global market for the lion's parts, particularly in Southeast Asia.
And that's a relatively new threat to lions, which has come about because of the decline in the tiger bone trade. So when the tiger numbers got so low, because it's very popular in China and elsewhere to drink wine made from tiger bones and make medicines from them, that because people could no longer get hold of tiger bones because it's illegal to poach, you know, and trade in tiger bones, that the next best big cat, as it were, was the lion. And it's believed to have the kind of same prowess and the associations of vigour and to give tonic properties and things like that. And so as a kind of replacement for the tiger bone, lion bones have been in demand and are growing in demand.
Yeah. Well, Sara Evans, stand by for just a moment because I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Luke Hunter, he is Chief Conservation Officer for Panthera, the global wildcat conservation organization. He's also author of many wildlife books, including Wildcats of the World. He's joining us today from Bern, Switzerland, because he's there working with the International Union of Conservation of Nature to develop protocols for lion conservation. So, Luke Hunter, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magda. It's good to be with you.
So tell us a little bit more about this habitat loss that Sara Evans was walking us through. I mean, how rapid is the loss of habitat for lions, and can that be reversed?
Yeah, that's a really key question because it has been rapid, especially in the last three decades or so. And we know that that's one of the main drivers of lion declines, and so that's why lion numbers have collapsed in many areas across Africa. But associated with that, and I think this is a really important point for your listeners to understand, is that there are vast wilderness areas in Africa, most of them under some sort of statutory protection, mm-hmm. so the great national parks and game reserves of Africa, which are also under a lot of pressure, where the habitat itself hasn't been lost, but there is a significant amount of pressure on the wildlife within those protected areas. And so that's because people either are poor and need protein from these areas and they're hunting in there, or more disturbingly, and in fact more prevailingly these days, is there's a commercial element to that pressure that bushmeat, as it's called, the hunting of wild lion prey, actually has a commercial value now, and it's being consumed at much faster rates in more recent years in urban markets in Africa and even beyond internationally.
I see.
And so the habitat destruction itself, while it continues and there is pressure, in many parts of Africa, I think we've passed through the worst bottleneck of those things, and so there's some hope there. But we're additionally confronting this issue that even in the great protected areas of Africa, there where the habitat remains and lion populations remain and their prey remains, but they're under very, very, very intense pressure from this illegal hunting in those areas.
So, Luke Hunter, let me ask you, I mean, the trophy hunting is one thing. But that's almost exclusively wealthy white people coming to Africa to kill the most charismatic animals on the planet. But these other pressures that you're talking about, I mean, those are pressures, if there's a market for bushmeat, as you're talking about, et cetera, aren't those pressures born of things like poverty, that the Africans living with these animals may not have any other choice, or of the many farmers who actually see these, who see the lions as a threat because, you know, they take the livestock, they invade the farms that those families are trying very hard to subsist on.
That's right, Magda. Yeah, you're correct on those. So there's a number of issues going on here. You know, one is, in some cases, you're absolutely right about people hunting wild animals in Africa. It's because they need protein. But I think the answer is, you know, you really need to find ways to alleviate people's poverty. You need to give them alternative ways that they don't need to rely on wild animals for dinner, for their food. The issue of farmers, or rather particularly livestock owners in Africa, killing lions is somewhat different in that mostly happens outside of big protected areas, and there are still a number of areas where lions do exist outside of protection. Sarah is right, many cases it's still in or exclusively in national parks and game reserves, but there are areas, non-protected areas, that are really important for lions and wildlife, but they are human communities. They are people who live there and mostly live a subsistence existence on livestock. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you know, lions can present a very real hardship to rural African people because they can be dangerous. They can kill livestock, and they certainly will at faster rates when the wild prey has been denuded.
Yeah, I mean,
in that case...
Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, in that case, that you know, it's very understandable if people are killing lions because they're frightened, justifiably in some cases, of the danger that those lions might present to their livestock.
I was just saying that I'm seeing here though that there that local conservation groups in Africa are coming up with some creative ways to assist both farmers and lions. I was reading about the desert lion of Namibia and how there's a conservation group there that's started to wrap cloth, a form of sackcloth, around the stockades where farmers keep their animals so that the lions view the structure as solid and may not actually try to break through them to get to the animals on the other side. So it seems as if there are means by which local organizations can work with farmers to both protect their livestock and the lions as well.
Exactly right, and I think that's absolutely the solution, and also reason for great hope. There are so many fantastic individuals and organizations working exactly on solutions like that, and it's actually not rocket science. You know, it turns out that there's a small toolbox of solutions. It includes the tarpaulin or the sackcloth that you said. Lions just apparently seem to view that as a barrier, and so if you're doing a very good job of taking care of your livestock and you bring them into corrals at night, and many communities do and some communities don't, but if you do that and then you have these additional safeguards in place, so for example the barriers, you build really strong bomas, and that's something that myself and conservation practitioners that I work with local communities to help, but you reinforce those night corrals so that when lions do come sniffing around, as they invariably will if there's livestock available, they have a really tough time of getting into those corrals at night and causing great damage. So I really think there are very many of these solutions that local communities can embrace with a little bit of help, a little bit of access to the resources or maybe the training, and really it's a win-win, as you say, for both the people and the lions.
Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Springfield, Ohio. You're on the air, Eric.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi, what's your...
So my question is, I think some people underappreciate how important an apex predator is in an ecosystem. And I would like to ask Sarah, what exactly would happen if we were to lose this really powerful predator in this ecosystem, you know, around the lower trophic levels of energy in this ecosystem?
Eric, thank you for your call. Sarah, do you have an answer for him?
Yeah, if we lose the lion, we will pretty much in the end lose all the wildlife that kind of comes under it, the smaller animals. The ecosystem will be dramatically affected because the prey that the lion feeds on, so the antelopes, the herbivores and things, they could become, their numbers could become unchecked, which will just affect the vegetation. There'll be be, you know, super grazing. So it will have a dramatic effect, not just on the fauna, but the flora as well. One of the kind of big motivations behind saving the lion, or using that as the flagship, as the icon, is that if you save the lion, you save everything else as well.
Sarah, that makes me wonder, I mean, how much further can the wild lion population decrease before it's basically genetically extinct, because the genetic diversity amongst the remaining lions just isn't enough?
Well, in West Africa, where the lion decline is at its most dramatic and it's most worrying, because down in the south of the country, lions aren't doing too badly, really. But in the west, you have small populations. There's one population that's just about 400 individuals, and where you have populations that are even smaller and populations that can't meet each other. So they're isolated, either because they're in a fenced-in national park or protected area, or just because of urbanisation, but their kind of corridors that are linking them up aren't passable, then eventually they won't be able to breed healthy offspring. And some conservationists call those very small groups the living dead, because, you know, they can't breed themselves out of extinction, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, Sarah and Luke, hang on here for just a second, because I am delighted to welcome into the conversation one more person. Paula Kahumbu is joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. She's the CEO of the Kenya-based conservation group Wildlife Direct. They operate throughout Africa, including in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, and Uganda. And she also writes the Africa Wild column for The Guardian. Paula Kahumbu, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
It's really a delight to have you. So tell me, I mean, you're doing this conservation work in Africa right now. I mean, how dire do you think the lion's future is?
Well, two things. I mean, lions are an extraordinary species because they have actually survived in an environment which has a lot of people in it. I mean, Nairobi National Park is right in the capital city of one of the biggest cities in the world, in Africa, and we have lots of lions in that park, and that park is surrounded by people. So lions are incredibly adaptable. They also breed very fast because they can have many cubs, you know, 7 or 8 cubs in a go. And so they are actually quite adaptable, and they can rebound if they're given the chance to. We once had, the population was brought right down to 7 individuals, and now they're over 45. But the problem is severe because we have growing human population. We have communities who are quite poor, who can't afford many of the devices that I heard being talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And they also don't make any benefit from the lions. So in their opinion, lions are rather worthless. But on the other hand, our communities, especially in Eastern Africa and other parts of Africa, have lived with lions for eons. They know how to live with lions. But as we become more and more developed, you know, children are going to school instead of learning the ways of the land and the ways of the tribe. So they're losing a lot of their traditional knowledge. And I think that is possibly why we're seeing greater intolerance. And in Kenya, the greatest threat to lions is intolerance. People are killing lions because they are taking off livestock. And livestock is the livelihood and the only means for some people to get enough money to pay for their children to go to school.
Yeah.
So when a lion kills your livestock, it's disastrous.
Well, do you have an example, or I suppose there probably, hopefully, are multiple examples on how that relationship can be changed for both the families and the lion's benefit?
Yeah, we have this extraordinary story in Kenya of a young boy. His name is Richard Turere. And he, at the age of 11, invented a device to keep the lions away from his father's stockade. So similar to what Luke has mentioned earlier, you know, the people at the Maasai community keep their cattle behind wooden and wire mesh stockades at night. This little boy figured out that the lions wouldn't attack if he was walking around at night with a flashlight. So he devised a very simple flashing system of lights that tricks the lions into thinking that he's awake walking around, and he's not. He's in bed. This worked really, really well. And because it was an invention that came from the local community, it was just adopted wholeheartedly, not just in Kenya, but all across Africa. So this is, I think, a really excellent example of how innovation can come from the people who are affected themselves. Mm. It's an innovation that is cheap. It's affordable. He made it from bits of broken flashlights and bulbs and, a battery from an old car, bits of wire that he found. He's now, it's something that has really turned things around for a lot of those communities. And
well, Paula, if I just may...
Forgive
me for jumping in here. We just have to take a break here in the next 30 seconds. So Paula Kahumbu joins us from Nairobi, Kenya. She's CEO of the conservation group Wildlife Direct. We're also joined by Luke Hunter, Chief Conservation Officer with Panthera, and Sarah Evans, author of When the Last Lion Roars. And we're talking about the current perilous state of the African wild lion, 20,000 of them left on the continent, and what can be done to save them. Would love your questions and your thoughts about what we lose if we lose this greatest king of beasts. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what could happen when the last lion roars. That's the title of Sarah Evans' book. It's called The Last Lion Roars, The Rise and Fall of the King of Beasts. And we're talking about it because there are only some 20,000 wild lions left on the African continent. And really, hunting is part of the problem. Poaching is part of the problem. But as we've been discussing, habitat loss and encroachment and human-lion interactions and the complexities around that are really one of the main pressures around the last wild lions in Africa. And I wanted to explore that a little bit more. So listen here. This is tape from the Namibia Broadcasting Corporation. They reported last year that after losing 12 head of cattle, a local farmer in Namibia killed two lions, calling them aggressive. Now, his nephew and fellow farmer Jason Inoko, speaking through a translator, called on the government for help.
We are in serious problem. We need assistance from the government. Some of the dead cattle had calves, and we will be expected to dig deeper into our pockets to feed them. If government can meet us halfway, we'll appreciate.
So that's part of the story. But also, let's recall the global outcry that happened a couple of years ago after Cecil the Lion was killed by a Minnesota dentist who was there in Africa trophy hunting. Now, Minnesota protesters were so outraged, they stood outside the office of dentist Walter Palmer, the hunter who shot and killed Cecil. They called for him to face charges in Zimbabwe.
Extradite! Extradite!
Okay, so they're calling for extradition of a hunter there. But on the other hand, Zimbabwe native Goodwill Nzo'o believes that Westerners care more about Cecil's killing than the everyday suffering of the Zimbabwean people. Here's what he said to ABC News in 2015.
We have these issues that do exist already that we're not even talking about. Hunger, people dying of AIDS. But all of a sudden, one lion dies. Then the whole world blows up.
We're joined by Paula Kahumbu. She's CEO of the Kenya-based conservation group Wildlife Direct. She's with us from Nairobi, Kenya. And also by Luke Hunter, who's Chief Conservation Officer for Panthera, and Sarah Evans, as I said before. And Paula, let me turn to you on this, because I'm very interested to hear what you think about this. Because when we talk about conservation efforts for lions, and so many of the pressures for conservation come from the West, and I'm specifically thinking the White West, you've heard this term. Some people call it a form of green colonialism. I mean, is there not some validity to that?
I don't think it's a very useful conversation to have. I think it's obvious that people love lions. I mean, in America, you grow up on documentaries about these extraordinary animals. You have Lion King. Of course you adore lions, and so do people all over the world. And in Africa, we have our own value system for lions. And I think that what you're hearing is a real concern that Africa's value system for our extraordinary wildlife has been discounted. And that, you know, I can understand that, and even I was upset. I was disgusted with what happened to Cecil. I think we all will feel concern for an animal that doesn't have a voice for himself, or wildlife that cannot speak for themselves. So, of course, we will try to defend those animals. And sometimes you think, well, people can take care of themselves. I think it's really important that we build bridges. And look, for example, I gave you the example of Richard Torreira, this young boy who is from the local community, who is saving lions. And I can't tell you how difficult it is to get him support to promote his project. So, of course, people feel that it's not fair. We've got all these great ideas. We've got our own solutions. Why aren't you supporting us? Why is it that it's always outsiders who are coming to help us? Because it does feel wrong. It does feel imbalanced. And there is quite a big backlash across the continent because of that. And I think it's something that would be very easy to rectify.
Well, Luke Hunter, give us your view on this, because I know conservation is vitally important for the planet, for all of us. I mean, of course, including and perhaps most importantly for the Africans who are living with and among these animals. But I mean, how, you know, what are some of the ways that we can go about doing that without it just ringing of hypocrisy, right? Because I'm thinking here in North America, we wiped out pretty much, you know, Sarah Evans was telling us earlier, we definitely wiped out the ancient lions, mountain lions and cougars. For 150 years, hunters were given free rein to eradicate them, wolves, etc. But now we're turning around and the West is telling Africa what to do with its animals and its land. How do we avoid that hypocrisy?
Yeah, indeed, and there is a deep hypocrisy there. I mean, in North America, we still, you know, we permit the shooting of, you know, 2,000 mountain lions a year, you know, which are sport hunted, and people don't seem to be aggrieved or understand that issue as much as, you know, they got excited about the shooting of Cecil. So I think it is hypocritical, and it also, it does, I think, speak to a real sort of misunderstanding in the real issues facing conservation and African communities in Africa. And so the, you know, the commentary from the Namibian farmer was something that I've heard so many times over the years and was absolutely key to resolving. That chap had a real issue with lions. He was the lions were killing his cows. He took the reasonable response of addressing that himself because no one else would assist, the government or NGOs or local actors or whoever. And so I think, you know, the only way we succeed here is we actually help with solutions, and the global community needs to be part of that. International development agencies, the people who can contribute significant funding, and then the local actors and the NGOs, and I include the international NGOs like Panthera in this, who actually help with, they assist with resolving the problems of people like that Namibian farmer.
Interesting. Well, let's get a call here. Rick is calling from Mazamani, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Rick.
Hi, Magnus. Question, I'm a North American hunter, and I know that hunters in North America provide a significant amount of conservation dollars, and I know people that have hunted in Africa and that fees are expensive and that those dollars also are used for conservation. So the question is the negative impact of taking an animal in Africa outstripped by the positive impact of the conservation dollars that can be used or not?
Oh, Rick, great question. Let me turn that to Paula Kahumbu, because there's a whole sort of, there's an economic ecosystem around some of this hunting in Africa, right, Paula?
Yeah. It's an interesting challenge, and I'm so glad for that question, because it creates a lot of confusion. In Kenya, we're actually in the middle of a conversation along those lines as well. And this is what the response is from the local communities across the entire country, that how can it be illegal for me as a local person to kill this animal for food or a predator because it's affecting my livestock? And yet we're going to give a license to somebody else from some other country to come and kill the very same animal. It doesn't ring right, as you said. It sounds a little bit hypocritical. And I think our governments need to do much more. I'm really sorry to say. I think our governments, yes, they are prioritizing development, and they've become a little bit blinded to the fact that this wildlife that we have that is so unique and special anywhere in the world is going to put Africa in a very special place in 20 or 30 years. It would be horrific if we lost our lions, our elephants, our rhinos, our giraffes. But with them, Africa stands apart from all the other continents, and it would make us a lot richer. I really appreciate that there is a difficult situation. There are no easy answers, but I think our governments have to do much more. Mm.
Sarah Evans, I mean, I'm seeing some figures here that trophy hunting could generate, I don't know, 100, 200 million for Africa? Is it possible that other forms of tourism could make up for the loss of that if trophy hunting were to go down?
Well, that's difficult to say. Some people think, yes, that it will be possible, and that there can be an alternative to trophy hunting as a way of saving the land. Because, for example, at the moment, around 1.4 square kilometres are taken up by trophy hunting ground, which is 22% more than the area covered by national parks. Mm. So you have to look at what, in order to get rid of trophy hunting, what will we lose in terms of land? Because that hunting land might become farming land. It won't necessarily remain as habitat for lions. So it's just putting lots of measures in place, and changing land over from trophy hunting land into protected areas where there is no trophy hunting, just doing that gradually on a place-by-place basis, because some places are sustainable, and although we might not like it, for the time being they are saving lions' lives. So you don't want to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were.
Yeah.
And I think you have to look at them all different. Yeah.
Go ahead, Paula. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, so Kenya doesn't have trophy hunting at all. Mm. There is nothing. There's no bird shooting, no trophy hunting whatsoever. And the physical land area under conservation has doubled in the last 10 years because private landowners and communities have voluntarily put their land aside into conservation. So it's not just ecotourism or high-end tourism. They're trying all kinds of other ways to generate funds. It could be energy production. Sometimes it's cultivating, you know, things like aloes. But many, they're not making money. They're not getting rich.
Yeah.
But they feel that it's the right thing to do to keep the land open. And frankly, the beef production improves, and so does milk production, improves under a landscape that has wildlife as well as livestock.
Yeah.
So there really is this recognition that done well, wildlife and livestock actually can coexist very well together.
Well, I want to get one more call in here. Harvey is calling from Augusta, Maine. You're on the air, Harvey.
Hello, Omega. The question was asked earlier in the show, what is going to happen after the last lion roars? And I believe you have a historic model to tell you exactly what's going to happen. After the last wolf howled in Yellowstone, there was a population explosion of the prey animals, the elk, and they created a major negative change in the environment of the whole park area, and you may happen there.
Hmm. So. Harvey, it looks like your phone's dropping out on us, but thank you so much for your call. Harvey, they're pointing out that we have removed apex predators from environments here in the United States, and he was pointing to the wolves of Yellowstone. But maybe there's a hopeful twist to that, because they were reintroduced as well. So, Luke Hunter, we've just got a couple of minutes left here to go, and I want to end the show by exploring sort of what it is. You pointed to this earlier, what the global community can do here when it comes to saving and conserving lions. Because a couple of years ago, in perhaps in response to the death of Cecil, the United States put two subspecies of lions on the U.S. endangered list. You're there in Bern, Switzerland right now working on developing protocols for lion conservation. So what role does the global community have?
It has a really, really important role, Magna, and I think the fundamental issue is to massively escalate the commitment of support, and I mean the financial support as well as expertise or other resources that might be useful, to African range states, and particularly to African governments who have made, in some cases, these extraordinary commitments in terms of conservation real estate set aside. And so, you know, Zambia, for example, has over 30% of the country set aside under some sort of conservation, and it's over over twice what we have in the United States, by way of example. But Zambia lacks essentially the financial support to be able to really effectively manage that national parks network. And if we're able to commit that support, then we don't need more national parks. We don't need to create more parks, more protected areas, or take more land away from local communities. We have the potential to recover the lion massively in those parks that already exist, but their populations are just so significantly depleted.
Yeah, and
so I think, you know, the focus needs to be on a massive commitment, the likes of which, you know, we give annually from the affluent democracies for rural development, which is very worthwhile. We just need a very small percentage of that to go towards specific conservation activity, which would save the lion and the massive network of wilderness that they live in.
Yeah. And Paula, you were saying a little earlier that, of course, there's also enormous room for direct investment in efforts going on the ground in Africa, as you were talking to us about.
Absolutely. I think what we need is a rethinking, actually, of what's going to work, because we cannot have people who are very poor being negatively affected by wildlife. We can't have wildlife literally being a cost to people, and at the same time we're making money from the same wildlife through tourism. So it's almost like taking money from a poor person and putting it into a rich person's pocket. So we do need a complete rethinking of how this model is going to work for all these areas. As Luke said, there are vast conservation areas, but they're surrounded by local communities who are very poor. And if they are going to host this wildlife on their landscapes, then there should be some clever way to innovate for that. If you go to France, they're using the local lottery to raise money to support the protection of the heritage. And I think we need similar kind of ideas, maybe a global lottery to support the protection of Africa's, you know, spectacular heritage.
Yeah. Sarah Evans, you know, we've been speaking sort of very practically throughout the course of this hour, but I want to acknowledge that lions are spectacular animals, right? I mean, they are incredibly magnificent. There's something about their grace and their power that really, I mean, it stirs the soul. So are we at risk, as we are with any species that goes extinct, are we at risk of losing something wild in us if the lions go away?
If the lions go away, I think we'll lose something very special in ourselves. We'll lose a connection to nature and wildlife, and also having that role as a guardian of wildlife. Just think that we have let those animals down. That is something that will kind of haunt our children's children if that was allowed to happen.
Mm. Luke Hunter, I mean, you've loved these animals for a long time. What do you think?
I agree with Sarah. I mean, it's just walking in a landscape that has lions is just an incredible feeling, and it's an empty, sterile landscape. I think if we lose those large carnivores, it would just not be the same.
Mm. And Paula Kahumbu, final thought goes to you. What do we lose within us if the lions are lost?
Look, we evolved in Africa together with lions and elephants and many other species. They are tattooed in our DNA. We lose lions and we lose a part of ourselves. I mean, it's no surprise to me that people around the world all love lions, and they don't need a reason to. They will never see a lion, but they still love lions.
Yeah.
So yes, what we discover is that we failed. And I think that is just a terrible, terrible lesson and a horrible gift to give to our children.
Well, hopefully it's one that we won't do. Paula Kahumbu, CEO of the Kenya-based conservation group Wildlife Direct, joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. It has been such a great pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much, Paula.
Thank you.
And Luke Hunter, Chief Conservation Officer for Panthera, the global wildcat conservation organization. Thank you so much for joining us, Luke.
My pleasure, Magnet. A real pleasure.
And Sarah Evans, author of When the Last Lion Roars, The Rise and Fall of the King of Beasts. Sarah, thank you.
I'm delighted. Thank you.
And we have an excerpt of Sarah's book at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.